She said I got to talk into the mic. Hi, everybody. I'm Kitty Streit, and I'm a very grateful member of the Fellowship of Al-Anon, which includes Alateen. Hey, and a member in good standing of the Tuscaloosa Al-Anon Family Group in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Tony, I want to thank you for last night. Enjoyed it. I bet you're glad it's over. I will be come noon. I'll settle down maybe. Extremely nervous. Don't know what I'm going to say. I'm going to let go and let God, hopefully. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to share. Why do we say that? I'm not grateful that you asked me, I don't think. It's like, I will be, yeah. Yeah, every time I'm asked to share, I always have something going on in my life that I really need to work my program to its fullest. And it's very important to me that I not only talk the talk, that I walk the walk. As I said, I live in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and that's a Roll Tide town. I know that I'm in the land of the enemies at the moment. Not really. If I can't joke with that, about that, then, you know, that's no fun at all. But we moved to Alabama, after I'd been in the program about 5 years, and used to be called a damn Yankee. And then I was told what the definition of a damn Yankee is. And that's someone who comes down south and doesn't go back. And that made it okay, because I don't ever want to shovel snow again. Anyhow, I want to go back and share a little bit with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I grew up in a home of a religious home. I was the middle child of three girls. My father's name ended. He was an only child, and so my maiden name is Brewer. And anyhow, born in Pennsylvania, raised in Maryland, and then moved to Missouri my senior year of high school. Y'all, this is hard. Anyhow, I moved my senior year of high school, and I swore at that time I'd never do that to one of my kids. So don't ever swear that you'll never do that, because you will. We moved our kids. My oldest went out of school, our senior year of high school. We moved to West Virginia. And it was in Missouri that I met my knight in shining armor. He belonged to the Junior Brewers, and you can guess what they did. They drank. They had fun. They were the fun group, and I liked that. In my family of growing up, my older sister was a brain. She liked school, and she studied, and she got good grades, and I set out on the capacity to make my parents think I was stupid. And there's nothing stupid about Kitty, I found out in Al-Anon. She liked school and I didn't. And I did enough to get by, and I had fun. And that went, you know, through my pattern of I like to be around fun people and do fun things, and do just enough to get by with and study. So I had my parents kind of convinced that, you know, that, well, just like I go, because it's not coming. Anyhow, my older sister used to walk around and we compared. I had a grandmother who was about 4'10", and She used to say, well, Kenny Ann, if I thought a thing like that, I'd be ashamed of myself. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Shame, shame, shame. And I'll tell you right now that I have a shame core that is unbelievable to this day. I have to work on it continually. And because of Al-Anon, you know, I work on that. And this older sister of mine, she has a degree. She has her doctorate in psychology. I gave her a book of Alcoholics Anonymous one time and told her it might help her in her dealing with other people, and she put that on the shelf, set it aside. She didn't need that. But anyhow, I have a younger sister who's 7 years younger than I am. And when I went through high school, I went away to college, and my knight in shining armor went to the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, and I soon followed him a year later. The other thing I need to tell you about this, as I was taught growing up that I was raised in the Protestant religion, and I was told never to date Catholics. That was a no-no. So, and that was fine until we moved to Missouri, and I met this knight in shining armor, and guess what? He was Catholic. So, I went away to college and went 2.5 years. I got kicked out of school because I was out having fun. And and when I came home, then I started to work, and I finally became engaged in this guy who went to the Naval Academy, and I moved to Annapolis, Maryland, and worked in Washington, D.C. for a while, and then in Annapolis. But I got pregnant, and we got married, and he had to resign from the academy. Which, I tell you some of this is because it set off a pattern in my life of the guilt and the shame. You know, I brought shame to my family. You can see I'm not 21. And back in those days, the illness was put on the female to tote the line. And that, you know, I brought shame to my family because I became pregnant. And it wasn't his fault. You know, boys will be boys. And they're just doing what's natural. Girls are too, let me tell you. See, this program has brought some honesty about in me. But anyhow, for a long, long time, it's like I felt this shame and guilt because I denied my spouse his college education. I denied him his religion. And therefore, you know, our income, which would have been kind of solvent if he had graduated from the academy and gone on to have that naval career, we'd have been okay. We wouldn't be watching the pennies and the nickels. So it said, and what just went through my head right now was, who says so, Kitty? You know, the disease of alcoholism reared its ugly head in our house. And so who's to say that he wouldn't have spent every cent that he made drinking? But anyhow, we went back to Missouri, and I began to raise children, and he started to work, and he would do things that, like parking in an alley and constantly getting tickets, and he'd say that was an occupational hazard, you know. Everybody does it. But he'd get caught, and he'd have to pay fines. And it's like we didn't have two nickels to rub together. And I was given the job of managing the finances in our home, and because he didn't want to. And then if we didn't have funds, you know, who got blamed? So I was set up for this, and I tried to make things right. I tried to do the right thing and be right and be good and what have you. And but this guilt core that I had was constantly feeling shame. If you met my younger sister today, she'd still look at you and say, she sinned. Kitty sinned. And for a long, long time, I felt that I had. My mother-in-law couldn't understand why we weren't married in the Catholic Church. And we had gone, I didn't rock those boats. I didn't argue with my spouse at all. I usually do what he wanted to do. And because the pressures were put on us to go to get married in the Catholic Church to make our marriage right, and my mother-in-law said, you know, he must not think it's going to work out, otherwise we'd be married in the church, and therefore he'd be okay. So we went to talk to a priest, and the priest said to me, can you get a letter from your parents stating that you had never been married before? And I said, no, I won't ask them that. And they said, well, can another relative tell you? And my spouse looked at the priest and said, if you can't believe my wife that she has never been married before, then we don't need this. And we walked out of that rectory and never went back. And so we didn't get married, remarried in the Catholic Church. And through my pre-Al-Anon walk, I started, my parents would say to me, Kitty, when you're visiting your in-laws, why don't you take your children to church? The church that you want to go to, and I'm sure that your mother-in-law will respect you for that. And so Mike's mother would ask me if I wanted to go to church on Sunday, and I would say, yeah, I think I will. I'd gather up the courage to tell her, yes, I would. And she would, you know, she'd find out where the church was and make sure that we got there. So I did take the kids to church, and I was one of those that it's like, I'm not going to send them, I'm going to take them. And I think there was a respect in that respect with that. We traveled, my spouse was a traveling salesman, and so he traveled Monday through Friday, or, you know, Sunday through the week, and I was left with the kids. And alcoholism would progress in our home, and, you know, he would say to me he'd like to be home, but, you know, when he was home, he wasn't home. And I didn't understand that. There was a comparison always of, you know, trying to be better and do better and keep the peace in the house and never argue and what have you, but he was never there. And so he would leave on Saturday. He said he was going to go to the post office about 5 till 12, and I believed him. He was going to mail his reports and what have you to the company, and then he wouldn't come home Saturday afternoon. It's like, I think, what kind of fool does he think I am? So I go out looking for his car. Go by the bar where he was, and then I go home and I call him, and I say, when are you coming home? Or in the evening when he'd come in town early, I'd go by. I'd leave the kids at home. We had four kids by that time, and I'd leave the kids at home, and I'd go out in the car and look for him or take him with me and then come back, and I'd call him at the bar. And I'd say, you know, when are you coming home? And will you bring some bread home, or will you bring some milk home? I'd just been by the dairy bar, but I'd tell him I couldn't go by, you know, with these kids, get them dressed, and go out, and I'd already been out. Or at night, I would stand by the window, and I would wait and watch for his car to come in the driveway, and then I'd run and hop in bed and pretend like I was asleep. Pray that, because I always took everything that he did very personally. I didn't feel good enough. Disease of alcoholism really paid its toll on me. I had absolutely no self-worth. And I felt strapped by the kids, I'm sure. Our oldest daughter, I vowed and declared she'd never know. You know, I never realized that she could learn to count and that she would figure out that we had to get married. And so for a long, long time, I just felt so guilty about that. And eventually, my spouse became suicidal in the disease of alcoholism. And he was out there trying to kill himself. I took a gun out of his hand one day and put it on our bedroom shelf. I hid it from him and lived in fear that he would ask me where it was. You know, it was registered in his name, and I knew that if he asked me for it, I would have to give it to him because it was his gun. I never realized it until he told his story one time, and he said, you know, she never realized I had the shotgun right down by my desk. Never even thought about the shotgun, but the pistol I took from him and hid it on our bedroom shelf. And I was so afraid he was going to kill himself. You know, I love this man. He was the love of my life. And he was out there trying to kill himself, as I said. He was trying to do what he do with carbon monoxide. He'd disappear and he wouldn't come home. And one day he came home and he said, Kitty, he said, I'm going to put myself into a rehab center called Hidden Brook, which was in the state of Maryland. It was about 15 miles from where we lived. And he said, if you have any communication with me, you can go through our minister and he can. I didn't understand that. I thought, if he's coming home, how's this work, you know? And so I delivered him out to Hidden Brook. And the director out there took us into his office, and he looked at me, and he said, Kitty, you leave him to AA because they understand where he's coming from. And you go to Al-Anon because they know where you're coming from. I heard this director talk to my spouse like I had never heard anybody talk to him before. And my husband took it, you know? He listened to him. And he went to that rehab center, and I was invited to come out to that center on Sundays for visitation and to counseling. And I remember sitting in the counselor's office one day with my feet up on the chair completely because we were watching a mouse run around the room. Anyhow, but I went out, on Friday nights, we'd go to the meeting in Bel Air, Maryland. And, I remember thinking, how are they going to know I'm not one of them? You know? What's the difference? How are they going to know I'm not an alcoholic? But anyhow, we met, and I started to get busy because these people, they accepted me, they invited me in. I got busy in those rooms. We at that time we smoked in the rooms, and I clean ashtrays and clean the room or help them put out literature and what have you. And out of the I feel so scattered, y'all. You know, one of my first Al-Anon meetings, I heard a lady who had been in there 7 years, and she came into that room and she was sharing that she had a problem. And that was good for me because I learned that, you know, life has problems, and that just because he went in to get sober and he got sober, it didn't mean that everything was solved and everything was rosy from here on out. Life has problems. We had literature there. We had the One Day at a Time book. This is my original book. As I said before, we didn't have two nickels to rub together. And they gave me this book, and they said, you pay for it as you can. Because I had said to them, well, he has a 24-hour-a-day book. I can read it. And they said, no, Kitty, you take this. And you use this and you pay for it as you can. I shall be forever grateful that they did that. We had that book, and we had the Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, and we had the Living with an Alcoholic when I came in. I came in November of 1972. That's a little over 41 years ago. And it has been a lovely, lovely journey. Not everything has been rosy, as I was sharing this morning, that my walk in these past over 20 years has been with my kids and the relationship that I have with my children today. They are extremely important to me. I work very hard on keeping my nose out of their business and building a relationship with them. And thank God for Al-Anon for that. Anyhow, this, we had very little literature, and this girl, she brought in a Cosmopolitan magazine, but she identified it that she was going to chair the meeting from this and a paragraph from it. And that particular night, our group representative or district representative visited our meeting. Well, you don't do that, but she was allowed to chair that meeting because, as I said, we had very little literature, and I think she was talking about infidelity, and that was addressed in that book. And you know, as long as you identify it, but you don't spend the whole meeting on it. So today we have more literature, and we use our literature because it is written totally by us and our point of view. So anyhow, I went to a lot of AA meetings with my spouse in the early years, and I listened to the AAs, and I needed this. I listened to the AAs share on living in sobriety and doing different things, and just instead of just putting the plug in the jug. I know today that I feel today, I'm very strongly about this, that there's more, and you've got a lot of sobriety in this room. I learned that last night. I hope sobriety. My feeling about sobriety is it's not just putting the plug in the jug. There's more to it than just putting the plug in the jug. It's walking and living a way of life. I don't call infidelity sobriety. I had that in my life. It's a very hard thing to deal with. I took it extremely personal. I would hear people say, well, you know, boys will be boys. It's just the way it is. You know, I don't feel that way. So I had people in my life that I used to watch. We used to go to a lot of open AA meetings. There were couples there that they talked about dry drunks. And I'm telling you, when you're both on a dry drunk, that's something to behold. You know, get in there and dig in your program. And, you know, my program is my program to walk the way I needed to, you know, to walk, to do what I need to do for Kitty one day at a time, one step at a time, one minute at a time, one second at a time. And there are many, many times I had to do that in my program, is walk just 1 minute at a time. The alcoholic, in 1985, we had two children leave home. My grandmother died, and a very close friend of ours died. I had major surgery with complications, and I felt Chicken Little, the sky's falling in. And I hung on to this program just minute by minute. I felt at times like I wasn't working a very good program. But I just had to walk through I had to walk through the pain instead of around the pain, which I had done for years. You know, push it away and not look at it and not deal with it. And in 1985 I really started to have to work this program and walk through the pain. I want to share with you a story. If I ever think that I'm okay, and that I never did anything crazy, I have to think about this story, because in the throes of alcoholism, you know, I took the gun out of his hand, and he had many, many wrecks, and he came up with these stories of he was hit by an Indian chief, so on and so forth, and they were company cars. And I mean, they would call the house and they would ask where Mike was, and it's like, well, he's working somewhere. I was kind of his chief cook and bottle washer. I had to answer. He worked out of the house, and so it's like I'm always covering up. I'm ashamed of what's going on in our home, and I'm scared to death he's going to lose his job, because how are we going to survive? How am I going to get a job and feed these kids? Because I knew what I didn't graduate from college, and I knew what I made when I finished work, and it's like, how am I going to survive? And so, anyhow, I worked at this dairy bar in Upper New York State, and at about 11 o'clock, we closed the doors, and then this is in midwinter, or full-fledged winter, because we had a blinding snowstorm, and I have to close up. I'm there alone. The police usually come by to make sure I'm okay, because I'm taking the money home from the dairy bar. And so I cleaned the floor and got everything cleaned up, put the money in the money bag, and went out of the dairy bar. And we had this blinding snowstorm outside. Ran out of the dairy bar, locked the door, got in the car, and I thought, oh my God, somebody stole the steering wheel. I wonder how they did that. As I looked down at the floor, hit my head, straightened up real quick, looked out of the window to see if anybody was looking, got out of the back seat into the front seat and drove off. Now, there is nothing wrong with me. I still feel that feeling. I mean, I have a very high mechanical aptitude. And it's like, how on earth did they steal it? And it was funny. And so I laugh about that and think about that when I think, you know, it was all him, not me. I never did anything crazy. Yeah. Anyhow. You know, sorry to tell you about 1985. My spouse decided to choose a different way of life. He said he was going to leave, and we ended our marriage. We ended our marriage at 24 years, and that was an extremely hard time for me. I thought we'd go into the gray-haired ages and travel and go to AA meetings and conferences and things that we did. He was very active in AA, and I was very active in Al-Anon. And this wasn't for me. And it was, to say I was just devastated was unreal. You know, it just, so I kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I kept going to meetings. And kept doing service work. You know, singing NT, I think they were on this board, were they not? NT used to tape. And they brought us, they took us to many, many conferences. Anyhow, I kept going to area assembly, and we had election one year, and I found myself, somebody asked, was I going to stand for alternate delegate, and I said, no, I'm not ready for that. But when they asked about chairman, I found myself being pulled out of that chair, and I was absolutely amazed when I was elected chairman of the area assembly, and amazed that you all could see something in me that I couldn't see in myself, and that you had enough faith in me. After all, you know, all these things were happening in my life, my outside life, and you saw something in me. And I served as chairman, and I served as alternate delegate, and I had was greatly blessed by serving as delegate. In 1995, when it was the last year that we served in New York, and the first year, and then I went to the first year in Virginia Beach. And the thing about New York was I was able to go downtown New York and go to the offices where they packed the literature and sent it out and what have you. And there were some workers there, and I was able to thank them for doing that service job, for sending that literature that saved my life. You know, not for money or for fame, but to reach out to an unknown and absolutely save my life and start me on a journey that was is beyond my wildest dream. The alcoholic went his merry way, and I was my son. He joined the Navy. He went in the Navy, and he went to Memphis, and then he went to California, and then he went to Cuba. Anyhow, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but the pieces to be picked up, and through the recovery of this program, of being able to work the 12 steps and the 12 traditions in my life and in my family life and piece things together. Sharing with Bo, the thing that is my kids. The relationship I have with my kids today is really a blessing. And we can talk about the past. They'll ask me questions, and when they ask me questions, then I answer honestly and openly. And they're as open and honest with me as they, I do. We have great relationships, and it's only because of this program. The alcoholic went out to Wickenburg, Arizona. It was right, probably, our divorce wasn't final yet, I don't guess, or maybe it had just been final. Anyhow, it had been final, and he went out to Wickenburg, Arizona to a rehab center out there, and the family was invited. And I'm sharing this with you because this is an intricate part of my story. He went out to this rehab, and it was out there. None of the rest of the family could go, and I chose to go. To go through the process of the recovery week or whatever. And I got out there. I had a lot of questions in my mind, but I came back with answers to questions that I didn't know that I had. I got out there and found out that the alcoholic had remarried before our divorce was final. But anyhow, it added to the pain. And I kind of closed off and couldn't call anybody at home. I did call one person and told him to call my kids and tell them I got out there okay and everything was fine. That's where I learned the definition of fine, too. So when I tell you today that I'm fine, I'll say usually in every sense of the word. Anyhow, I decided to go through that recovery week. And the alcoholic continued to play some games. He was told to stay away from me. He didn't. He taunted me with different things. We were given an assignment one day, and I was told to meditate on something. And it's like my mind's blank. I'm trying to detach from this guy and the family, and I'm crying, and I look terrible, and I want to look good all the time. Anyhow, I'm sitting on this hill in Wickenburg, Arizona, in the desert, and looking out over the desert, which is barren and desolate and ugly. There's no flowers, maybe a cactus here and there. And the mountains that are mauve and beige and pink, gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I'm looking at this scene and I'm thinking, how can I relate this to my life? How can I relate this to my life? And this is exactly how I felt about my life. Barren, desolate, nothing pretty. Absolutely gone. Everything is gone. But if I keep my eyes off the circumstances and out there where they belong, I will never, ever, 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 ever be alone. And so I came home from Wickenburg, Arizona with this picture in my heart. And today I know that I am never, ever alone, no matter what happens. I told him at the breakfast table this morning, I woke up with a thought that went through my head, and it's like, I don't know that I've ever woken up with this. This is the day that the Lord hath made. Let us be glad and rejoice in it. That was my first thought this morning. And before I came up here, I had the privilege to serve on the Executive Committee for Real Property Management for a property in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And he used to stand out in the yard and look at these trees swaying in the breeze, just graceful and what have you. And they're Leland cypress trees. And I'd say, why don't we have them here in Alabama? Well, we do now, but at that time we didn't. And it's like, I just love these trees. And I just stand there in awe and say, look at those trees. Well, I opened my blinds this morning. Guess what? It's right in front of my window. The Leland cypress tree. Yeah. So when I feel that God isn't with me, he sends me a message. Always sends me a message. I'm never, ever alone. My kids, out in Wickenburg, I learned that my oldest daughter had been molested by an alcoholic when she was young, and she carried that secret for 16 years. I didn't know. I didn't know at all. And she confronted me one time years later when she became suicidal, and she confronted me like, why weren't you there for me? And I had enough Al-Anon in me at that time to keep my mouth shut and listen to her and let her share her anger, because she had every right to be angry at me. Every right. You know, it's like I used to deny my anger. But anger's okay. It's what you do about it. And so she went through her thing, and I listened to her, and I said, honey, I don't know where we both agreed that we don't know that I would have done anything about it had I known at the time. That's how sick I was. But anyhow, I said, I don't know why this has happened to you at all, but I do know beyond a shadow of a doubt that our higher power will use this in your life. And you will be able to reach your hand out to another human being and say, this is what happened to me, and I have come through it, and we can walk together. I share this from the podium because, you know, we're as sick as our secrets. And I have had people come to me, men and women, and say, you know, this happened to me, and I haven't been able to tell a soul. And I'll hug them back and say, thank God the secret's out. Now the healing can begin. The healing can begin. This older daughter and I have a great relationship today. She's been married 3 times. Her second husband was an alcoholic. And she said, I will not have an alcoholic in my home. And I looked at her and I said, you got one. What are you going to do with him? Anyhow, she's married to this huge guy who looks down on me. He graduated from Auburn. And we have a fun week coming up, I think. Anyhow, I get enough courage and I'll say to him, you know, what happened to your team this week? And we laugh about that, but he would never, ever. He's one of those die-hard Auburn guys that if you paid him several million dollars, he wouldn't vote, you know, he wouldn't cheer against this Alabama at all, or cheer for Alabama. But we have a good relationship, and I think he likes me. Anyhow, they take me to dinner every so often. And my second daughter lives in Roswell, Georgia. She married a guy. I thought they had a real solid marriage and a real good marriage. Anyhow, about four and a half years ago, I went over to her house. When I want peace and serenity and quiet, I go over to her house. And she has a nice deck and trees in the back and the birds and what have you. And anyhow, I got over to her house one Friday evening, and I went in the house and I said, "Hey, Beth, I'm going to smoke a cigarette." And she said, "Well, what would you like to drink, Mom? Would you like a Coke or Diet Coke?" I thought, this is kind of strange, but I'll take Coke. Went out and sat on the porch, and she came out and she said, "Mom," she said, "I got something to tell you." And I said, "What is it, honey?" And she said, "Mom, I want you to know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Music to my ears. Music to my ears. Because there were many times I left her home and thought I'd never see her again." Now, she was one that she worked. She had a very, very good job, but she drank. She drank. I mean, she'd have always have a glass in hand. It was those elephant in the room. We never talk about it, but it was there. Her husband was unfaithful to her in their home, and I think she had a little over a year. No, from May till December. And she called me and she told me what was happening. And she reached out to me. And I could say, "I understand, but you're going to make it. It's going to be okay, and you'll walk through this. And I'm sorry for the pain that you have to feel and you have to go through, but it's going to be okay." They divorced, and I still go over there and enjoy. And I'm gonna go Tuesday. I'm gonna spend Thanksgiving with her, and she does this great big Thanksgiving spread, and she likes to cook, and we enjoy each other's company, and the rest of the family will come in. I have a younger daughter who lived in Kansas City, and then she went to Oklahoma, and eventually, she came back to Tuscaloosa to live. She and her husband divorced. She's the one that was left with me when her dad left. And we have a good relationship, I think. When she was in high school, it's like she couldn't. We built that relationship. Because of this program, we worked on that relationship. She talked to me about a job, and I'd ask her how she's weighing things, and I'd say, "You know, I don't know what decision you're going to make, but I know you'll make the right one, and I support you in what you're doing." And, you know, I could have told her what I thought she needed to do, but I would not have been given the gift of hearing how she weighed things out. And because of this program, I've been able to stay out of their business. And grow and enjoy their company and watch them grow as young men and women. Anyhow, she came to Tuscaloosa, and I think it was to watch me. Because I'm getting old and getting up in years. And the other kids are concerned. I don't know why it was, but she picked Tuscaloosa. And she also was suicidal. She was suicidal in high school. And she also drinks. And I watch this. I was concerned I didn't like the way she talked, what she was saying, and those red flags were going up. And I went to a meeting, and after the meeting, I went over to her house and knocked on the back door, and she came, and she finally came, woke her up, and she came. And sitting there talking to her a minute, and all of a sudden this knock came on the back door. And then they went around the front door and they knocked, and it happened to be the police. She had broken up with a boyfriend, or he had broken up with her. And so the policeman came in, and I said, "What's this all about?" He said, "Just want to know if everything's okay." And I said, "Yeah, everything's fine. It's in order." He said, "Got a call that there was someone thought that maybe someone might be doing something to themselves." And I said, "Well, everything's okay right now. Thank you, sir." And I thought, well, this guy had a little bit of smarts, you know. He called the police and told him to check on her instead of coming checking on himself. You know, I remember one time when an AA called us to come down, or his wife called us to go check on her husband, and we went toddling down there to check on it, but we also called the ambulance, you know, because we couldn't do anything except listen to them. But if there was really an emergency, we needed to have the people that were capable of taking care of that emergency. So these are things, and I thought this guy was pretty healthy that he called the police and told him to check on this. But, you know, this is something that couldn't be swept under the carpet anymore, out in the open. And my concern was valid. Anyhow, she put herself in rehab last year. And I wish I could tell you that she's sober, but she's not. I don't know. I know that we went to the beach this past September, and my second daughter that's sober said, "What would you do if Cricket drank?" And I said, "Watch her. It's up to her." And so that evening she did drink. So I know that she's not sober as of September. She looks good. You know, we go to lunch every so often, but I don't know what she's doing. And I haven't seen her in AA, you know, I don't go to the AA meetings other than Saturday night, but I don't know what she's doing. But, you know, the seed has been planted and the door is open. And I must allow her the dignity to do what she needs to do and go where she's going on her own. I love her and I care about her. Do I like what's going on? No. There's a lot of things in my life that I don't like what's going on, but they're reality. And because of this program, I can walk in my reality and take care of Kitty and be the best Kitty and the best mother that I can be for those kids or friend to carry the message. My son lives in Germany and has been over there for about 4 years, or three and a half years. He moved his son, took him out of high school, his senior year of high school in December, and so Trey graduated from Kaiserslautern High School in Germany. He went the last 6 months, and then he came back to the States and is going to the University of Alabama. So for someone who has lived alone for over 20 years, I have this big blob that sits in my family room behind a computer. And I say that. This is a boy that his mama left when they were stationed in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I was given the duty to body train this kid. And I thought he could go on demand. I used to take a class over to the Phoenix House on family issues, and so one of the AA guys would babysit with Trey. Well, but he said he didn't do potty, so I would say, "Trey," take him into the restroom and say, "You know, you gotta go." I had to make amends to this boy because I was screaming at him, you know, three-year-old, gotta go. That's the kind of control I thought I had. So I've been a part of Trey's life. I had to keep him when he was from 3.5 months to 6 months when Jay and Lisa were trying to get a home in Gitmo. They left him with me. I was a chore, you understand. And then when he was his first year of school, well, when they came back from when Jay came back from Gitmo, I had Trey, and I had to potty train him so Trey could go out in California, so he could go into daycare. So I had him for 3 months then, and my gift for that was I got to go to Disneyland or Disney World, whichever it is, with them when I took him home. And then I had Trey the first year of his school. And Jay called me and he said, "Mom, I'm going to flight engineer school in Pensacola, Florida. Will you keep Trey?" And I said, "Sure, son." Never thinking about reading, I mean, this is first grade when he's going to learn to read, right? And that I have to go to PTA. So anyhow, I had Trey his first year of school. And now I have him in college. And as I said, his mother left when he was about 18 months old. And from this boy, I have learned, you know, I think kids, it's instilled in each one of us that we want our parents to be perfect. You know? The love that he has for his mother, although she didn't come around, or she'd make promises and not show up, you know, and he'd wait. There's just an instilled love that nobody can ever take that away. The same fear I had when my spouse left me. I thought possibly that he could turn the kids away from me. You know, it's my responsibility to build a relationship with each one of my kids, not anybody else's. I'm responsible and accountable for that. And that's extremely important to me, you know, to be as open and honest with them as I can be. And because of this program, the steps, traditions, the concepts, and applying them in my life and working them on a daily basis, I can do that. So I have this person in my living room, my son. I'm not going to go into this too much because this is taped. I have another daughter-in-law who's a really sick cookie, and it's done a lot of damage to this boy. It is my job with my grandson to provide him a stable home and give him some tools, because it came to my attention. I would ask him his first 6 months of college because he was failing out. Don't you have an advisor? I'll figure it out. Until he was visibly shaken. And I reached out to a friend of mine who my sponsor in this program, who knows me warts and all. And I turned some things over to her because this stepmother had written a paper on I Hate Deadbeat Parents. And there were some very vicious things in there. And I once again tried to protect my grandson from this. Anyhow, I turned this over to her, and I thought, she can get some help for him. Because, Kitty, you're not going to be around the rest of your life. And my biggest concern for him is that he has the tools to live life on life's terms. That's the only gift I can give him. So I turned him over, and she got him into some counseling, and his boss said, you know, I think he had a 0.8 average. Trey works at the University of Alabama in the computer. He's a computer tech person. And his boss said, you know, this boy, he saw these papers and what have you, and he said, I don't normally keep anybody on my staff that has a grade point average like this, but this is the only thing this boy has going for him, and I'm going to keep him. And I say, thank God, because I'm not getting any financial help other than Trey's got a scholarship, and I'm living in fear he's going to lose that scholarship, okay? But I keep being reminded that's not my game. So they got him some help, and he's enrolled in the university, and he was to graduate this past December. However, last May, I'm sitting at my desk at work, and I get a call from the University of Alabama Police Department. Do you know where Trey Stride is? And I said, well, he left for work this morning. He's at work. Well, I said, he works in the tech department. Well, which one? I don't know which one. So I said, but this professor does. So I gave him all this information of this Al-Anon friend of mine that I had turned him over to before. And she said, I called her and told her what was going on. She kind of blew it off for a minute, and then evidently the police department called her, and she said, I will get back to you, Kitty. And so they took him in tow and got him back into counseling, and she sentenced him to Al-Anon. He went to 5 meetings, and he said it didn't work. But what he had done was he had started to compare himself. He had gotten an art major, and my friend asked, you know, whoever pointed him in that direction. I knew, but I didn't say. But anyhow, he was comparing his artwork to others in his class, and he did not measure up. And so he quit. He literally quit on doing his, going to class and doing his art stuff. And, you know, Grandma sitting in her office, and all, I get this call from the police department. And I'm telling you, you're hard to sink. But he came in that evening, and he went back into counseling, and he's changed his degree to philosophy. Now we don't know what he's going to do with it, but he's supposed to graduate next December. And my job is to give him a stable home and stay out of his business and love him just the way he is. That is a challenge. We went to watch a football game, and it was interesting. I observe him. It is a big thing for me to watch him instigate a conversation with another adult human being, to reach out, to share, to talk about something. He'll go with, when he's around my older kids, like they go to movies and what have you in there. So I enjoy watching this and watching him grow. And every once in a while, you know, he walks around, he'll ask me if I'm okay. I think it's good to have somebody in the house to watch out for me or just to be there. He does what I ask him to do. If he's going to be late, he'll say, he's come to me before and he says, Grandma, I'm going to be late. And I'll say, okay, how late, Trey? And he'll say, 10:30, 11 o'clock. Tell me what your late is. You know, and he's never failed. That's his late. And when he comes in, it just, my mouth, I know, dropped to the floor when he said that. So I've been given the gift of this program to continue to put one foot in front of the other. I was sharing with somebody the other day, I know we don't advise, but I think my walk is reaching out to Al-Anons, people who've been affected by this disease, and helping them, and maybe giving them some tools. This little girl was in our meeting the other week, and there were two, she and I were there, and we would kind of open the meeting, and she was telling about she had gone on a job interview. This girl had no idea how to job interview. And so I just shared with her, you know, this meeting and of different, I said, you know, you can ask some questions. It's okay to ask some questions. Or to say, you know, what do you mean? When they told her that they had asked her what experience she had, and she told them, and she said, well, that's not any experience. And it's like, it's okay to say, what are you looking for? What do you need? You know, I've been through this with my grandson. It's been a long time since I was in college. And I thought you had advisors. I have no idea what they have at the University of Alabama other than a football team. Anyhow, they do have that, don't they? Bo told me to have fun. You know, this is a serious program, and sometimes I take it too seriously. I guess I'm about to end, huh? I'm sorry I was so scattered. I want to do this perfectly. I want to share because this is my lifeline. You know, I'll be here until the day I die. And it's so great to see faces that I don't see very often, and to make new friends along the way, to be able to say my name's Kitty, and I'm a very grateful member of this fellowship called Al-Anon, to be able to love myself because you gave me that gift. You loved me until I could love myself back. And look in the mirror and say, hey, you ain't so bad, kid. I have to do what I need to do for Kitty. I have to do the things, no matter what my children do or my spouse had done. In fact, he died in 1999. Also didn't mention that I took care of my parents. I felt like I became a caretaker a lot of times. And the people were always coming and going out of my life. But with my kids or what have you, I have to do what I need to do for me so that I can live with me. I was estranged from my son who's in Germany, who's coming back sometime next year, I guess. He has to get a security clearance, but he's required to come back, and he's going to be in Washington, D.C. That's a good thing. He's not going to be close at home. I keep a relationship with him, but never mind. You know, when I was estranged from him for 2 years, that was something I didn't share. Jay went into a diabetic coma. He quit taking his insulin because he was gaining weight. Okay? And they did call, and we sat in the hospital room. I had been estranged from him for 2 years, and they called and they said, you know, the doctor said, come. And so we went over to Atlanta, and the first thing I did was pick up the phone, and I called every Al-Anon that I knew, and I said, put him on your prayer list. And I sat in that room, watching the machines, and knowing that it was going to be okay. I have to give you the dignity to go where you're going and do what you need to do in order to get where you're going. To love you just the way you are, not necessarily approve of, but love you just the way you are, and meddle out. And I need to keep coming to Al-Anon to be reminded of that. At those times I sent him Christmas gifts, I've had them returned. Birthday cards, I've had those returned too. But I keep doing what I need to do to feel right about what I need to do for me. Okay? Thank you all for being there. And thank you all, AA, for giving us the steps and traditions to live this way of life, one day at a time. God bless you. I love you, each and every one of you. Thank you.